The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey folks, I'm Alex Dowd.
And I'm Katie Reif.
This weekend, The Conjuring becomes a trilogy with the theatrical and HBO Max release of The Devil Made Me Do It. Of course, this new film is also the eighth entry in what's become one of the most profitable of modern horror franchises, an ongoing decade-spanning saga of haunted houses, demonic pranksters, and righteous paranormal investigators. On today's episode, we talk about the whole Conjuring universe and the newest case from the files of the Warrens.
Welcome to Film Club.
Hey folks, welcome again to a new episode of Film Club. I hope everybody had a nice Memorial Day weekend. We're back, and today we are going to talk about the Conjuring franchise.
Yeah, summertime staple, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, the first one definitely came out in the summer, and I feel like they do normally sort of line them up for a summer release. I guess occasionally we'll get one around Halloween as well.
But definitely
started as a summer horror thing. At this point, the Conjuring films are now represent the, the second highest grossing horror franchise?
But only if you count Godzilla as a horror franchise, which is, Godzilla.
It's debatable.
Kind of, yeah, it's very debatable. Godzilla crosses genre. I would call Godzilla a sci-fi series more than I would a horror series, so.
Yeah.
If you don't count Godzilla, it is the highest grossing horror franchise of all time.
That's wild. I would never guess that, honestly, because
I know
you would think it would be something like Friday the 13th or something. But I guess as ticket prices have gone up, the Friday the 13th movies made bank in their day, but ticket prices were lower. I mean, if we wanted to get into adjusting for inflation or something, I'm sure the results would be different. But the Conjuring films are obviously all of all released, honestly, in the last decade, and with ticket prices being what they are, I guess it sort of makes sense that they would be that high.
I think probably back in Friday the 13th day, a film wouldn't necessarily open globally, you know, like a slasher movie wouldn't necessarily open globally like the the Conjuring movies do.
Very good point. These films are sort of hits around the world in a way that maybe something like Friday the 13th wasn't. The rollout's just different, too. I mean, you talk about the way that movies used to open, and now they open on like something like a Conjuring movie. And obviously, there's a new one coming out this weekend, and I was going to say it probably is going to open on 4,000 screens, but I guess that's not really true probably at this current moment.
We're still in the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like it's going to be a while before something opens in the States anyway on that many theaters again, because in some places in the country, there aren't theaters still haven't opened. I think many places they have reopened, but a lot of them are not running at full capacity at this point. So,
yeah, totally. And I mean, we're late in the franchise too. Now you said this was the eighth entry into it. That's, you know, it's not as big of an event as like, you know, when The Conjuring 2 came out, it was a big deal.
Very true. They've kind of at this point, it's become a little bit more of a. It's a little less special. It's a little less of an event. I will say, though, that the Conjuring franchise is one of the few attempts at an Avengers-styled shared universe that seems to have paid off. You know, there have been several other attempts at that over the last few years since the release of the Avengers and since what Marvel successfully pulled off its expanded universe plan. And to those listeners who don't know, an expanded universe or an extended universe when it comes to movies basically refers to a number of films that are all part of this same narrative universe. And they're more. It's more than the traditional sequel, which continues the story of one film. It's like a web of different stories that are technically in their own way self-contained, but all feed into this larger hub. I don't know if that's a good explanation of it, but
yeah, no, that's what a shared universe is. And what's one thing that's interesting about the Conjuring franchise is it is a very Catholic shared universe. You know, all demon and exorcism films kind of proceed from a Christian place, but it's very explicit in the Conjuring movies that the main characters, Ed and Lorraine Warren, we'll talk about them more in a little bit, but they're very much warrior cares for God in these movies.
Oh, yeah. I mean, would you say that the original, the origin story of this franchise is Original Sin?
Well, I hope they make that one. I hope they make a Conjuring movie set in the Garden of Eden. Yeah.
Well, they, you know, they have all
with
been.
With Lilith.
they have all at this point been period pieces. You know, we have yet to see a Conjuring film set in modern times. They basically span from the early 50s until the late 70s at this point. I guess depending on how well this one does, we might see some more that go a little bit further into a little bit closer to modern times. But right now, they're all in that same kind of window. And they all of them do not involve the Warrens necessarily, but they all are connected in some way. Sometimes I would say in really clumsy and completely superfluous ways, where, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, one of them's a doll, which really, you know, it's a nice shortcut. You can just put a doll in a room and be like, ta-da!
Exactly. A doll can very much be lugged around to different places very easily.
Exactly. No problem.
But I remember watching the second Annabelle film, Annabelle Creation, which, in my opinion, is actually one of the better films in this series. But in that one, they bring up the nun for a character who had been introduced, a character, I guess she's just like a scary spirit, but a scary spirit that had been introduced in the second Conjuring film.
Yep.
And they kind of shoehorn in a reference to her into Annabelle Creation just to remind everybody in the audience that this is all taking place in one big world.
Yeah, she's in a spooky photo, which is kind of a common trope in the Conjuring movies. It's one of the things you see come up over and over again. But, you know, you mentioned that these are all period pieces. I believe the most recent one, The Devil Made Me Do It, is set in 1981, which does make it the latest of the Conjuring films in terms of timeline. And honestly, when the original Conjuring came out in 2013, I found the period setting to be very, like, cool and refreshing.
Yeah, I really liked that aspect of it. I mean, for one thing, the movie just kind of revels in – it manages to revel in some of the period detail of the time without being too on the knows about it, you know?
Right.
I mean, I think we get a couple of needle drops appropriate to the era. And, you know, obviously people are wearing the fashions of the time and driving cars that are contemporary to 1971. But the whole thing is it doesn't turn into like Forrest Gump or something where it's just like wall to wall, like time period signifiers, you know? It was kind of
Cruella.
Or Cruella, yes, to mention a recent film. The movie doesn't knock you over the head with the fact that it's set in 1971, but that does add a certain novelty to it nonetheless.
And I think that the setting, particularly with the first film, really dovetailed nicely with kind of the approach that James Wan was taking with the film, because, you know, when The Conjuring came out, that was 2013, and we were kind of on the tail end of, you know, two big trends that dominated the late 90s and early 2000s, which was PG-13 horror and torture porn. And James Wan was a key creator in establishing torture porn, because of course he directed the first Saw movie. And so when The Conjuring came out as an R-rated ghost movie, it really felt like a kind of back to basics retro approach, which I thought dovetailed with the period setting really nicely.
And I think it also kind of inspired a new, I feel like, a new movement. I mean, I feel like The Conjuring was a big enough hit that we have seen in the years since. We've seen not just this whole franchise that's been spun from it, but a number of other films that are trying to have what James Wan was having, so to speak.
Oh, absolutely. Like Ouija, Origin of Evil, is one that comes to mind for its meticulous period setting.
Yeah, yeah. So did you watch The Conjuring in theaters when it came out?
I saw The Conjuring on video twice. rented it and liked it so much I watched it again like a couple weeks later. I thought the first one was actually pretty scary. It was I remember watching it at home alone and then kind of like pacing around. I have this bad habit of watching scary movies at midnight and then kind of, you know, pacing around the apartment, like opening doors and checking stuff. If it's a good one, of course, you're checking your doors and your windows. And I definitely did that when I watched The Conjuring for the first time.
It's an extremely effective piece of mainstream horror, I think.
Yeah, it is.
It actually kind of, you know, it's set in 1971, but I think in some ways it recalls at least in its craftsmanship something like The Exorcist. I think that it definitely wants to be a 21st century Exorcist, down to like, the title coming down in giant, you know, in giant, very serious letters just to tell us how grave and serious this all is, you know. But for the most part,
it really announces that. And I believe they use the same font even as they'd used in The Exorcist for the title.
Oh, I didn't know that, but that makes sense.
Yeah,
actually,
I think it's the same font. Yeah. They're like, he's really announcing at the very beginning of the film, like, we're doing this 70s style.
Right. Yeah. Well, Juan 100% wanted this to be his The Exorcist and an Exorcist for a new era. And I think we can talk about some ways that I don't think it quite gets there. But it was interesting to see when that came out, just how much hype was surrounding the film. I remember a big deal was being made of the fact that it was getting an R rating, not for drug use, not for sexual content, not even really for the violence, but because it was supposedly so scary that it had to get an R. Now, I don't know if something like that really does a favor to a movie, because you kind of automatically, when you come into a movie like that, it sort of puts a chip automatically on audiences' shoulders, like, okay, this thing better scare me more than anything I've ever seen, or it's not doing its job, you know? But it is quite effective and quite scary in moments. And I do think that some of its effectiveness in theaters, I think, maybe had something to do with the degree to which Warner Brothers was embracing the hype around it as not only something that was supposedly very scary and apparently scared a number of censors watching it, but also as something that was very attuned to Catholic fears and to religious fears, you know?
Yep.
There were disclaimers at early screenings about it. They were like, you know, this is a movie that deals with very serious, religious issues, which is very funny to think that because it's really not a super serious film on those grounds, I don't think. But
not really.
At the advanced screening I went to, there was a Catholic priest there handing out holy water. Great PR, you know?
Good old-fashioned ballyhoo. I love ballyhoo.
Yeah, exactly. So they really built it up. But I do think that on a whole, the movie does withstand some of that hype. I mean, it is – you kind of have to go into it understanding that it is, like the films that came after it, kind of a funhouse ride. You know, that's kind of how these movies operate. And I think the first one disguises that a little bit more than the ones that come after it. It feels a little bit more like a satisfying piece of storytelling. It feels like one that takes its themes seriously and takes its characters seriously. But at its core, I think these movies in general are funhouse rides, right? I mean, they're about...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I would agree with that. They're all... And that becomes like, you know, like you said, the first one does make more of a gesture towards being a more, you know, serious story, a la The Exorcist, like you were saying. Mm-hmm. But I think with The Conjuring 2 is where they just – The Conjuring 2 is, you know, just a series of ghost scares. You know, it's a bunch of ghost scenes kind of strung together. Would you call them set pieces?
I would call them set pieces, I think. I think it's sort of a daisy chain of set pieces in a way, you know?
Yeah, And they're all about, you know, the tension in the release, the humming on the background getting louder and louder, and the door creaking open, and you're just waiting for the door to slam, and then it does, and you jump and you giggle, and you have a fun time.
It's the fundamentals of the genre, right? And and something I've always said about horror is that one reason that I think that we get some really good filmmakers that come out of the horror genre is that you cannot totally be a hack and make an effective horror movie, because you have to be able to effectively hit those beats. No matter how formulaic they may be, there is a certain timing that's involved. There's a certain mastery of atmosphere and, you're right, tension and release that's necessary. And jump scares get a really bad rap, I think, in horror circles and sometimes in critical circles. People sort of think of them as a cheap device. But The Conjuring is an example of how you can take that device, the jump scare, and you can kind of make a symphony out of it, you know?
I 100% agree. Like, that's one of the things I admire the most about the first Conjuring, is the way that it does weave all these jump scares together into a symphony, like you said. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Juan, he's really, really good at that. And another, you know, like, in terms of influential horror filmmaking, he's launched three different horror franchises, all kind of with, I mean, he launched Saw, which is a totally different thing, which isn't really about tension and release. It's not ghosts. It's not supernatural. I think that supernatural scares and more like violent serial killer type of scares, you know, torture porn, even you could call it. I think they kind of operate in different ways, know. It's more about squirming in your seat than being breathless when you're watching a movie like Saw. But Insidious and The Conjuring, you know, he launched both of those franchises too, and those operate in similar ways where it's a lot. But The Conjuring is more explicitly Catholic.
Totally, yeah. No, I mean, Insidious to me felt like a bit of a dry run to The Conjuring, honestly. Because I think that he was doing some of the things in Insidious that he ended up, I think, kind of perfecting in The Conjuring. Mm-hmm. The Conjuring was, like, I think a huge leap forward for him as a filmmaker and formally in terms of what he's doing. There's a real elegance, I think, to some of the filmmaking in it, even if that ultimately the film is operating you on the way of, like, a funhouse. It's a really elegantly constructed funhouse, you know? I've seen this in other films since, but one technique he uses at the beginning of the film that I think is really effective and is really, really smart in terms of how it orients us is we get this long Steadicam shot that takes us all through the entire house, basically. The characters are moving in, they're carrying boxes in, and we sort of follow the characters around the house. What it does is it basically orients us to this space. It says, like, this is the space that most of these scares are going to be happening in. We want you to have a notion of where these rooms are in relation to each other so that when the shit does start hit the fan, we know where we are in that house and we know where characters are in relation to each other at all times. And he starts playing on that later in the movie. Like we understand when a sound comes from off screen, where it might be coming from, et cetera.
Right, yeah. And, like, certain rooms have, you know, more spirits in them. And the thing that when I think about The Conjuring, I think about the scene where a character is going down in the basement and the door slams behind him and they're banging on the door trying to get out of the basement.
Yep.
Like, that to me is a really effective moment.
Yeah, is that the one where the ghost's hands come out and clap? They're like playing the clapping game, basically.
Yep,
yeah.
They're playing the clapping game, and he's hiding in the stairwell to the basement, and the ghost hands clap, and then the door is locked, and he can't get out, and he's like banging on the door.
One thing this series is really effective at, and it's especially true in The Conjuring, but it's been true in a few of the follow-ups as well, is this. It's this almost this checkoff thing where they will introduce an element that they can then play with or twist in a malevolent way. So be it like sometimes it's a game, sometimes it's a device in the house, like a dumbwaiter, for example. And they introduce that early so that we understand the mechanics of the game or of the device or whatever, so that then later the movie can do something diabolical with it.
Right, yeah. And I something that you keep mentioning that I think really speaks to the level of craft in these films is that there isn't really a sleight of hand in the sense that you understand the layout of the house. You understand the mechanics of the game that's being played, and they don't really trick you with that. It moves along the lines you expect it to move. They just use craft to make something that was not scary, scary.
Yeah, I mean, so much of modern genre cinema is spatially incoherent in a way that I think is really detrimental, because I think that if we are confused as an audience, it's harder to be scared. I mean, I think spatial incoherence hurts other kinds of films as well, including action movies. I think that being able to legibly tell what's going on in a scene is really important. But Juan seems to understand in The Conjuring how much it's important that we understand the spatial dimensions of a scene. And I think he really plays with them in smart ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
So these films do have they have a basis in truth. I would say a loose basis in truth.
Well, I mean, it's based on a true story. The question is, how true is the story, really? You know?
Right. Totally.
it's based on what's purported to be a true story. We'll put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, the films are the original Conjuring jumps off of the premise that we are following Ed and Lorraine Warren, two real life people who build themselves as paranormal investigators. Mm-hmm. Whether you buy that they were really doing that, as opposed to pulling a
taking
con of
advantage
some sort
of toxic families and nascent mental illness.
Yeah. The movies.
Looking at it that way, too.
The movies definitely do not entertain that notion really at all.
No.
I mean, the movies are 100%. The movies operate from the place of Ed and Lorraine really were paranormal investigators. Every case that they investigated was legit. There really were ghosts. There are moments in the films, in fact, where they will recreate things that happened over the course of these particular cases that have since been, like, widely debunked. There's a whole mm-hmm. bit in the second movie about this kid who claims to be possessed, and in the years since, I'm kind of remembering this as I'm talking about it, so forgive me if I screw up any of the details. But there's a moment in the second film where this kid claims that she can basically speak with a spirit, but it involves the characters have to look the other way
mm-hmm.
while she's doing it. So when any rational person might be like, oh, she's doing a voice while they're looking away. But the movies sure. so believe in that. The movies don't even entertain the notion that that could be the case, in the sense that mm-hmm. we actually get a vision of what's happening behind their back, as if Juan is just like, nope, we're buying fully into this. And I honestly don't have a big problem with it, to be honest.
I don't either, because, like, that's just part of the funhouse ride aspect of it, where you're kind of locking into the premise and just going along with it for the ride. And, you know, like, being a skeptic is good in theory, but skeptics can be no fun sometimes.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, The Conjuring 2 is based on a case called the Enfield Poltergeist, which was very, very, very famous in England and to a lesser extent famous in the U.S. And you can look up pictures from the case online, and some of them are really spooky to look at. You know, there are logical explanations as to why that girl is floating in midair, perhaps, but it's fun to just look at the picture and be like, oh, how spooky, that little girl's floating above her bed. You know what I mean?
Totally. Yeah, totally. I mean, I sort of think of these films as they are tapping into a collective interest in the paranormal and using their claims of veracity as a way to just to maybe give their audiences an extra shudder, you know? I mean, and obviously there are a lot of people, a lot of moviegoers out there who are genuinely superstitious. And, mm-hmm. You know, maybe you could say that the movies are exploiting people in the way that the Warrens themselves have been accused of exploiting people. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's that serious in the case of a movie. You know?
Yeah, I mean, in real life, you know, a lot of the stuff that the Warrens investigated has been debunked, obviously. But there are also some other aspects going on, like, you know, a few other paranormal investigators don't like them because they say, like, oh, well, they just show up when the investigation was already over and bring a bunch of cameras with them. And all of a sudden, everybody cares because the Warrens are here. But you know who's infamous for infighting? Paranormal investigators, just like any other subculture you can think of, you know, real life vampires, UFO enthusiasts, paranormal ghost hunters. They all hate each other. So.
Well, I'm sure the Warrens were extremely useful to other people in that field, in that they could be held up as, well, these are the TV psychics and the TV investigators. We're the real ones.
We're the real ones. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That probably is an element in some of the sour grapes you'll hear about the Warrens from other people who are like, no, we're real scientists. They were just superstitious con artists, for sure. But one thing, you know, one of my favorite news stories we've ever followed at the AV Club involved The Conjuring and involved this sort of question of, like, you know, belief and debunking and skepticism about their claims of the paranormal. So Warner Brothers reached an agreement with Lorraine Warren, who I'm not sure if she's still alive, but she was when she
died a couple years ago, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But, well, you know, in her later years, she signed a deal with Warner Brothers to give them access to the case files and basically the rights to make movies out of anything in their case files. But so she had signed a contract with someone else back in 1980 to write a book about them and gave that person access to the case files, too. And so this guy sued Warner Brothers over the rights to the Warren's case files. And, you know, it's a complicated lawsuit. Intellectual property usually is. But what it came down to in the end was whether or not these stories were fiction, i.e. whether ghosts are real and whether God is real. So that was actually litigated in a court because of the Conjuring franchise to decide if this guy's lawsuit had merit.
Wow. Well, how did it turn out?
The judge decided that ghosts are not real, unfortunately.
Well, but who is he to say, you know?
Listen, I don't rule it out personally, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I,
It should be noted, too, that Ed and Lorraine were two of the investigators on the Amityville case, too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they really did launch two film franchises.
Yeah,
they were the primary
yeah.
investigators in the Amityville haunting, so yeah.
I'm super curious if we're eventually going to get The Conjuring colon Amityville. I mean, I know that's its own franchise, but it does seem like a little bit of a missed opportunity to not kind of shove together those two name brands, you know, at least from a financial point of view.
Depends on who owns the rights to the Amityville story.
But here's the thing, though. It's a true story. So would they have
to... If ghosts are real.
I don't know if I buy that logic because, like, if I say I'm abducted by aliens.
Right.
If I come to you and I say, Katie, I've been abducted by aliens.
Uh-huh.
If somebody for some reason wanted to make a very boring movie about me saying that, that's news.
Okay.
I mean, I said it. It wouldn't be interesting news. Mind you, it'd be a slow news day. But... Wouldn't that just be a public record thing? Like, this person said that and that's the story, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I'd have to look back on the details of the lawsuit, but it did hinge on whether these stories were fact or fiction.
That's very funny.
Like, whether you could own them or not. Yeah.
we mentioned this. These are very Catholic movies. They're kind of, they're very wholesome films in their own way, you know?
In a way, yeah.
I mean, because for being, I mean, you know, There's some gross violence in some of them. There's some bloody some bloody sights and obviously some scares. I'm pretty sure all of the films in the series are rated R.
Mm-hmm, they are.
But they are nonetheless pretty wholesome, I think, because some of that comes from the Warrens, who the films do not attempt to make look cool or anything. I mean, the Warrens are basically, I mean, and in one respect, they're kind of like Christian superheroes. It's like if...
They are.
If Sherlock Holmes married Jean Grey and they went into business hunting ghosts together, is sort of the vibe.
Kind of. Yeah, you know? That's a really good way to put it, for sure.
Yeah. But at the same time, they're also really, really like youth minister. That's kind of their vibe as characters, you know?
It becomes more so as the series goes on. Their kids start factoring into the story, and then they become the kind of, like, you know, parents telling you to get in the car on Sunday morning and, you know, it's time to go to church.
There are multiple scenes in this franchise of Patrick Wilson, who plays Ed Warren, just busting out an acoustic guitar and playing a tune. And that's that's very youth group, you know?
Yes, it is. That's intense youth pastor energy. That is true.
He's like the, you know, he's like the kind of cool youth pastor who, like, knows how to talk to kids, you know? He's like, I can play music too, you know?
He's like, I went to London one time. We fought a demon over there. And the kids are like, cool.
I think both of the actors are Vera Farmiga as Lorraine and Patrick Wilson as Ed. And I've liked them generally. They have a kind of, again, it's a very wholesome energy, but they bring a certain charm to these characters who are a little, I think actually a little wooden on paper in some respects because they are so pious. They are so, they're not like Bible thumpers necessarily. These are not characters who are constantly browbeating everybody with religion.
Right.
But they're very pious, and one thing about these movies that I think I mentioned earlier that I don't think these movies quite reach the level of something like The Exorcist in terms of the danger of them is that I feel like watching the Conjuring films, it never feels like anyone's soul is really at stake, you know?
Yeah, the demon. Well, you know, one of the things about The Exorcist that people found so unsettling was just how sexual, you know, the stuff that the demon would say was. And you don't really see that as much in the Conjuring movies. You don't see that kind of like a perversity of the blasphemy that makes The Exorcist so unsettling.
Exactly. That element is not really a part of The Conjuring. Even the demons almost seem to be playing by, like, these movies are rated R, but they feel at their core like they could be PG-13. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I could totally see someone's Christian parents. They're an interesting case study because on the one hand, people's Christian parents don't like them going to see R-rated movies. But The Conjuring, really, they kind of reinforce faith, these movies, if you are Christian.
Yeah, and they also make the sort of warriors of God, the Warrens, and, mm-hmm. and people like them, look like pretty unimpeachable in some ways.
Yep.
You know, like, I would be interested in a Conjuring movie that suggested that the Warrens had some problems in their marriage.
Yeah,
you know?
Or even just, or question their faith. Because, right. you know, every case they encounter, you know, at the beginning of the movie, they'll have the crawl kind of explaining what's happening. And a couple of them, including the most recent one, it says, you know, this case was their deepest, darkest one ever. But it's never in a way that challenges their core view of themselves or how the universe works.
Right. And isn't that supposedly the true threat that the devil poses is to your inner goodness in a way? I mean, it always just feels like in the Conjuring movies that the two of them are, the danger that faces them is that they might get thrown out a window by a poltergeist, you know?
Right. Like, yeah, totally. Yeah.
It's never like that. These two are uncorruptible, you know?
Right.
Like, they're never going to, they're never really going to have a crisis of faith. They're never really going to do anything that's less than entirely pious. And so I don't feel like these films ever really have deeper moral stakes than simply there is good, there is evil. We are fighting the evil. We'll eventually put it down, you know?
Do you think that comes from this basically being an authorized version of the Warren story?
That could very much be a part of it, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's that. I think that's astute because, I mean, the fact that she signed over – she sort of signed over this stuff. I wonder if there were any caveats about it. Like, yeah, you can't really get into the number of people who were – there's like one scene in The Conjuring 2 where somebody – I feel like Ed is on a talk show and somebody is sort of throwing some skepticism his way. Mm-hmm. But the scene is totally on his side, you know?
Yes.
And
yes.
There's a scene in the new movie where they're basically trying to talk – we'll get into the new movie in a little more detail a little bit later. But there's a scene in the new movie where they're basically trying to talk this lawyer into taking up a demonic possession defense. And mm-hmm. Ed basically says to her, why don't you come over to our place for dinner and we'll show you our creepy museum of wonders or whatever the fuck they call it.
Mm-hmm. Which is a real place. You can go and visit it.
Yeah. And we'll let you meet – Annabelle, one of the stars of the Conjuring series at this point.
Yeah, indeed.
And the movie just I laughed at the cut because I found it kind of I think there's good timing in it. But the movie she's like, okay, I'll do it. And then the next cut is her sitting in the courtroom, obviously having agreed to take the case, visibly shaken by whatever it is
yes,
she saw.
Yes. Her she looks a little pale drawn, like she had seen a ghost. So,
and that's sort of how The Conjuring approaches a world of skeptics. It basically says, if you saw what the Warrens saw, you wouldn't be skeptical anymore, you know?
Mm-hmm. And it happens throughout the series.
It does.
That skeptics are converted throughout the series, yeah.
I really would enjoy a version of this universe that dared to actually... I mean, I don't need a version of this that basically calls them con artists and says that every... I don't think this series could survive if suddenly it decided to start questioning the very foundation of their work or anything.
Yeah, like their motives. Yeah.
Right, exactly. It wouldn't survive that, and it would be totally incoherent with what we've seen before. Mm-hmm. But I would like one that at least maybe threatened their lofty stance. You know, like,
well, maybe they fall for a hoax haunting or something.
Yeah,
and it
totally
makes them wonder, you know, are we going about this the right way? Something like that.
That'd be a great cold open, you know?
Mm-hmm. Call me James Wan.
So in any case, The Conjuring was a huge hit. They made a sequel that was also a huge hit. And they have made a number of films in this general universe, starting with Annabelle. Yep. Annabelle was the first spinoff. The evil doll that shows up at the beginning of the first film, the cold open of the first film. The movie actually opens on an extreme close-up of the doll's eye. Very creepy. And they have now made three movies, as many as The Conjuring, about Annabelle herself.
Yep.
And there have been a couple other ones. Almost all of them are basically spinoffs of some apparition we saw in the margins of another Conjuring movie, you know?
Yep.
They did The Nun as well, and the nun is a apparition that shows up in the she's like sort of one of the supporting spooks of
Conjuring 2,
yeah. Mm-hmm. But so yeah, I mean, so we now have these whole this whole web of interrelated ghost stories. I would say none of them are as effective as The Conjuring.
No, I mean, The Conjuring 2 is also effective, but it's not as well plotted or paced. Like, it feels very long and kind of anticlimactic in its final sequence. So, yeah. You know, the craft isn't as good in The Conjuring 2, but, you know, they still managed to have some pretty good jump scares in it. The yeah. infamous incident we mentioned on the podcast before where I screamed at the press screening. But I was having fun. But ever since The Conjuring 2, I think is kind of where it dropped off. And, you know, like creating this larger universe, like you said, there are as many Annabelle movies as there are Conjuring movies. And the Warrens are in the third one, Annabelle Comes Home. Mm-hmm. But they're not in the second one. They don't appear in Annabelle Origins at all.
Right, which is one of the earlier ones in the mm-hmm. in the timeline. Anyway, I believe that yeah. one is set just after The Nun. It's in the mid 50s. Actually, one of the better films in the series, I think, in part because I think it does one of the best jobs of reviving the values of that of the first Conjuring.
You mean like that kind of back to basics horror set piece thing?
Yeah, basically just understanding that this series basically exists to pull us from one creepy, effective jump scare to another, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And just looking at an environment as what are the different things we can play with here in this environment, you know? And there's mm-hmm. a lot of them in that second Annabelle film where I feel like they set a number of things up. They're like, here's a barn with a scarecrow. We're going to use that. Here's a dumbwaiter. Uh-huh. We can use that. Here's two girls under a blanket with a flashlight. Oh, you better believe we're going to do something with that.
Get ready, y'all. Yeah, for sure. You know what? Actually, I will actually defend the third Annabelle film a little mm-hmm. bit because it is one of the giddier Conjuring sequels in terms of the way it does the funhouse thing. That movie is a straight up roller coaster. It just goes and goes. It has little peaks and valleys, but it never, once the scares start happening, it never really stops. And there is one of those Chekhov's kaleidoscope in that movie. Yeah. But I thought that scene was pretty cool. I thought the third Annabelle isn't so bad.
I kind of liked that one too. And actually it wasn't just the scares, which I thought were solid. Mm-hmm. I thought the setup was pretty good. I mean, the thing mm-hmm. the thing kind of has this adolescent sleepover thing going on because it's, you yep. know, it's the classic two babysitters with or a babysitter and her friend with this little kid. So it's basically, and it kind of starts like Halloween, honestly.
Yeah.
And we even get like the early scenes of the movie are even in broad daylight, like Halloween. And we're just kind of hanging out with these characters. And I forget the name of the child actor who's in it. She's also in the I would. She has another relevant credit in the haunted house business. She's in The Haunting of Hill House. She plays one of the younger versions of the characters in that, and she's quite good, I think. And I think both of the girls are pretty good. It's as wholesome as the other movies in its own respect. These are like mm-hmm. very wholesome 1970s teens, basically. Mm-hmm. But it has a real charm to it in the setup, and then. And then, yeah, it has fun just – it's like a single location just sending these characters sort of scrambling through this house away from various – I mean, the hook of the third Annabelle is that we finally – basically they unleash a bunch of the horrors that are in the Warrens'
yep.
spooky museum. You know?
Right. Like when they say comes home, it's set like the day they bring the Annabelle doll home to the house. And, you know, all you need is one babysitter who doesn't listen when they say don't go into this room. And you've got a whole night of horror ahead of you.
I will say this. So they have a bunch of locks on the door, which is smart. Mm-hmm. And a lot of signs about not going in there, not opening the display cases. But then they just leave the keys sitting like behind a picture on their desk in the den. And it's like, you know what I mean?
Pious people can be very trusting sometimes. Maybe that's it.
So what about the third Conjuring? That is in theaters now. You can also watch it on HBO Max if you're so inclined, if you're not ready to go out to a movie theater yet. Conjuring 3, The Devil Made Me Do It is what it's called. What did you think of it, Katie?
I did not like The Devil Made Me Do It. It is the same director as did the last Conjuring film, The Curse of La Llorona, which is very tangentially related to the others and has a lot of problems. Perhaps the chief of which is that it's just not scary. It's just not a scary movie. I don't know if it's got, if we're late enough in the cycle of this series that, you know, all the scenes show, so to speak, and the kind of filmmaking tricks that the franchises use to scare you, if those tricks are just tired and they need to retire it. But Curse of La Llorona has lots of jump scares. None of them work. And I did not find The Devil Made Me Do It to be very scary at all. And it also brings in something that I was a little uncomfortable with, which was that this movie gets into like Satanism and witchcraft and kind of tacitly. I felt the way about this movie that I think you felt about The Witch when you first saw it. I felt that this movie kind of tacitly said that the satanic panic was justified because Satanists are real and they're after your children.
Yeah, I mean, and that sort of makes sense with the general philosophy of these films, which again are very Christian, I think. And if you think about it, in the 70s, the Warrens would have been the types who would have been probably at the forefront of decrying, probably the forefront of the satanic panic, you know? So it certainly makes sense in the context of this franchise, but I agree with you, I think, on that matter.
Yeah. I just kind of have a hard time because, like, innocent people went to jail during the satanic panic, and it's sort of a cultural impulse that hasn't gone away and is actually on the upswing because of, you know, the QAnon conspiracy. And just, like, watching it, I generally am willing to take buy the ticket and take the ride, like we were talking about. But this one, I just, maybe because it also wasn't scary, I was thinking more about the mechanics of what it was trying to say, but I was a little sour-faced walking out of the theater watching this one.
No, I think you're onto something, though, which is that we accept, I know that I can personally accept things in films that I find a little problematic if the rest of the film is sound. In other ways, you know?
Yes.
I mean, we all have our, what is it, our problematic faves, you know?
Of course. Yeah, of course.
And this is a much larger discussion to be had, and I don't necessarily think we need to get into too much right now. I do think there occasionally in the age we live in, there is some babies get tossed out with the bathwater, that somebody sees some element of a film that bothers them on some level that doesn't align entirely with their politics, and the whole thing is out the window. And I generally try to approach films with some degree of nuance and even recognize when something is doing something that I find that I think borders on offensive. I try to say, well, what's the rest of the film doing? Am I going to condemn the entire film because of this one element? What it comes down to, though, is that The Conjuring 3 does not work as a horror movie. It's just not effective. And I think you were right in identifying the fact that we have seen some of these tricks so many times. With all due respect, the director of this film is no James Wan. He does not have the timing quite right.
No. I was really disappointed to find out that he was making this one because Curse of La Llorona is really bad. It's a bad movie. This one's marginally better. Yeah. I mean, partially because it has Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson in it. But that's a bad movie. And it's kind of disappointing if he's been, you know, anointed as the caretaker of the franchise going forward.
And the difference is very easy to tell. I mean, if you put these two things side by side, and I think even somebody with maybe a layman's grasp of things like film form would notice the difference. You know, where Juan knows how to set up a scare really well. There are scenes in this one where there's like a kid who lies on a waterbed and something bad happens to him.
Satanic waterbed. Chekhov's waterbed.
Yeah. And in conception, I love that idea, and I think it's great. I think in execution, the timing's all wrong.
And they also did it in A Nightmare on Elm Street like 30 years ago now.
Very true. Yeah.
Yeah.
I should say the other thing that disappointed me about this film, and for a little plot background, this one is based on the true story of a man, I believe his name is Arne Johnson, and in the early 1980s, he killed his landlord. He murdered his landlord quite savagely. And in court, presented the defense that he was when he committed the murder that he was being possessed by a demon. The Warrens, of course, were involved. And the movie briefly flirts in a way that I found exciting with the idea that we might see a Conjuring courtroom drama.
Yeah, I think that we were both kind of hoping for that going into this movie, and it never materialized, though.
The trial is a non-entity in this film.
Non-entity. They skip straight from the plea to the verdict of the... I honestly, when the main plot was wrapping up, thought that they were going to end the film without ever saying what happened to Arndt. I honestly thought that was going to happen.
It's just such a missed opportunity. And what it is that I look at that and I see a failure of imagination. I see somebody saying, this should be the next film that we make. We should do this highly publicized case. And then instead of saying... Huh, well, what if we tinkered a little bit with the Conjuring formula, and what if we legitimately did something genre bending here and got into the trial, for example, you know?
Right.
And instead of doing that, they just said, how can we make this as much like a Conjuring movie with this particular story? So what it turns into is the Warrens investigating in order to get background information for the trial. So they start looking into what might have happened to Arndt, really, and we are introduced to a new villain who is sort of a Dr. Moriarty figure for them, in a way.
Yeah, for sure.
You know?
For sure.
Like normally the characters who they fight in the Conjuring movies are like, tend to be just sort of like...
Yes.
Spirits.
Ghosts.
You know?
Demons. Yeah. Yeah.
But now there's like a, this one introduces one that might have a little bit more, just slightly more sentience than that, I guess I'd say.
A corporeal villain.
Yeah, totally. And it's just not effective. And I just found myself wishing the whole time that we could get into, because there's a moment in the end credits, and I get, it's not really a spoiler because it's sort of a small thing, but there is archival footage in the end credits where somebody says to, they're interviewing Ed on television. And he says, like, what would it do to our legal system if somebody could go into a courtroom and claim that the devil made them commit this crime?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really good question.
It's a really good question.
I would be curious about that.
They could have explored it at length in this movie. They could have, I mean, they could have made it like, you know, like sometimes later in a horror franchise, they'll make a movie that's made up out of clips from the other movie. They could have had like Ed on the stand testifying about his past cases and showing clips, you know, from The Conjuring 2. And, you know,
yeah, we put the Warrens on trial. That's what it turns into.
Yeah.
The Warrens themselves are on trial. You could still end up reinforcing the franchise belief that they were not full of shit and that they were legit. Mm-hmm. You could still do that in the end. You could even do it in a way that was like, see, now we're doing that thing that we do sometimes as critics where you start rewriting the movie in your head. You're like, this is the movie I wanted to see.
The movie you wanted to see, sure.
Totally. But it would have been so great. I don't know.
I think, you know, of the movie that is, like you said, it is a lot of rehash. It's not very original for the Conjuring franchise. The villain they introduce is pretty disappointing. The jump scares don't really deliver. One thing I will give it credit for is this is a grisly movie. You know, there's like bloated corpses and things that are a little bit more graphic than you normally see in a Conjuring movie. But again, that could point to a lack of imagination.
Totally. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that it's sort of like, well, these jump scares are not as effective as the previous films, but at least we might gross you out a little bit, I suppose.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so I don't recommend this one, honestly. Although if you're a fan of the series, it is out there, and especially if you have HBO Max, it's really not much of a buy-in to just queue it up. But I found this on almost every level to be kind of disappointing, even in the context of a series that I felt as the returns have kind of been diminishing a little bit by bit with every entry.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this one does at the box office and where the franchise can go from here, if anywhere. Because, well, they're making The Nun 2, so...
Which, honestly, I just watched The Nun this week and it was not... super impressed with that one. I did like its universal horror / Hammer atmosphere, you know? Like it being set in this monastery that this abbey that's just like covered in wispy fog. I liked that aspect of it.
Yeah.
Otherwise I thought it was kind of weak. And can I say this too? It's really confusing that Tessa Farmiga plays the nun in the film and it is not revealed to be a younger version of Lorraine Warren. I was waiting for that reveal the whole movie. I mean, it's a younger sister, and they look exactly alike.
Yeah? Well, I think The Nun is the campiest of the Conjuring movies.
Yeah.
So maybe that's where they'll go with the franchise, you know? They'll be like Child's Play and just be like, well, we're out of ideas. Let's just make this goofy.
Yeah, totally.
So we'll see where it goes from here. But I think that the main storyline is definitely drying up at this point.
I think so. Okay, so I think we can probably both agree that the original Conjuring is the best of this franchise, right?
Yeah, it's not even a question.
Right.
The question is, what's the second best, really?
Yes, well, that's my question to you. What you can't watch The Conjuring. What's the other one you'd recommend?
Annabelle Comes Home.
Okay. I agree that's one of the better ones. I enjoyed it. I actually caught up with that very recently, too. For me, it's Annabelle Creation.
Yeah.
I just think that one has... That one is effective in a way that it feels parallel, at least to comparable, one might say, to the way that The Conjuring is effective. And
yeah.
I really do think that it's the director, it's David Sandberg, who made Lights Out. And I think that he has a lot of I think that he's got a firm grasp on the craft of this kind of horror. And the bonus is that this one does not have all the icky subtext of Lights Out.
Yeah, it's a good bonus. Yeah, because, you know, at its best, that is what the Conjuring movies are about. It's about horror fundamentals, and it's just about freaking you out. That's all we've got for you this week. The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It, is out now in theaters and on HBO Max. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to Film Club wherever you get your podcasts.
This week's episode of Film Club was hosted by me, Alex Dowd, and by Katie Reif. Produced and edited by Carl Blomberg. Our sound mixer and finishing editor is Zach Goldsboro. And our motion graphics designer is Julie Mullins. Check with us next week when we'll have a brand new episode. We're talking about 21st century musicals. Thanks.
See you then.